10. Johnny stood outside the ops room door and looked around the bowl. How quiet it seemed. The older Chinese children had quieted the younger ones and gotten them to bed. The dogs were silent, exhausted from the excitement of a while ago. The emissaries had all gone off to their apartments or guard duty over slime. There were no sentries in sight. The place seemed deserted, even though it was not late yet. To one brought up in the silences of mountains, the calm was welcome. It might be the sort of calm that is followed by blasting storm, but it was a moment's calm. Too many situations were running all at the same time for him to have any peace of mind. Who knew what would happen as a result of the emissary trial? He did not trust them. What would occur after this temporary suspension of war? What would they find in Edinburgh, in Russia? He told himself he had better not let his mind dwell long on these last two places, or he would edge over into anxiety and grief. That book he had read, that said you could handle things if you did one of them at a time? Good advice. Cyclo. He had been living in such a tornado that the question of Cyclo had become a sort of dull pain like a toothache. Was there any danger of counterattack, or was that just a shadow? Ha! This was a thing he had been waiting for. He had a transshipment rig. It was in fine working order. There were no planes in the air, no motors running. Cyclo. He would end right now that question of threat. He strode over to the console and almost fell over Angus. The Scot was sitting in a pool of light, working intensely with some rods and wheels. He didn't look up, but he knew Johnny was there. "While you were settling up with Schleim," said Angus, fingers flying around his work, "I parked a picto recorder on a peak on Tolnep to watch that moon. Reaction motors don't mess up a firing, only teleportation motors do. So I just fired it. But that was the only gyro cage assembled. I'm putting together a spare." "Angus," said Johnny, "we're going to find out what happened to Cyclo. We've got the machine, we've got the time." "Give me about half an hour," said Angus. Johnny saw he needed no help, and he wasn't going to stand around here and wait. En route to his room, he looked in at the hospital. They had left a woman nurse, an elderly Scot, and she resented being left behind. She looked up from a patient as Johnny entered. "It's time for your sofa and your shot," she said threateningly. Johnny knew he shouldn't have come in here. He had just wanted to see how the wounded were doing. The two fractured skull cases were lying in their beds. They seemed all right. But being Scots and left behind, they eyed him dully. The two burned anti-aircraft gunners seemed all right, but being Scots, they didn't want to be there with Edinburgh burning. "Take off your jacket," snapped the nurse. Then she took the bandage off his arm and looked at the arrow wound. "Ha," she said, sounding disappointed. "It won't even leave a scar." She made him take sulfur powder and wash it down with water. She jabbed an inch of needle into his good arm and squirted B-complex, stingingly, with a savage thumb. She took his temperature and counted his pulse. "You're perfectly well." It sounded like an indictment. Johnny had had a lot of practice in diplomacy that day. He felt sorry for these people. Jacket and helmet dangling from his hand, he said, "I sure am glad you people stayed. I may need lots of help defending this area." After a moment of amazement, they all came alive. They said he could count on them. And when he left, they were all chattering about what they could do and smiling, even the nurse. With the exodus of the adult Chinese, he hadn't really expected to find Mr. Tsung. But there he was. He had laid out a blue jacket on the bed along with some other items for change. But he was bowing and beaming. With his hands tucked in his sleeves, he was going up and down like a pump. He was trying to say something, but his English wasn't up to it, and suddenly he bolted and came back with Chief Chong Wan. "Well, at least you're here," said Johnny. "I thought the place was near empty."
"Oh, no," said the chief. "The coordinators are all gone. But we have guests, you know. The emissaries. So I am here, and the cook. There's an electrician and two anti-aircraft gunners.
He started counting off on his fingers.
Maybe a dozen people left. We do have one problem.
He saw Johnny go alert.
It's the food. I thought we'd be feeding all these emissaries, and we got ready to fix the fanciest Chinese food you ever heard of. But they don't eat our food. So we have all this food and nobody to eat it. Too bad.
To a people who had been pressed starving into the snowy mountains for centuries, it must look like quite a tragedy. Feed the children, said Johnny.
Oh, we have, said the chief. Even the dogs. But we've still got lots too much food. I tell you what we'll do. There's an empty apartment, and we'll set it up for a dining room, and we will feed you a beautiful dinner.
I've got something to do, said Johnny.
Oh, no problem. It is very stylish to eat late. The cook will be so pleased. Here.
And he made a dash outside to the hall and brought back a tray with some soup and small patties of dough and meat.
These are, no cyclo word, between meal bites. Help us out.
Johnny laughed. If that was all the problems they had, life would be a basking in the sun. He sat down in a chair and began to eat the snack. Tsung, after setting up a small table, was back to bobbing again. What's he bowing about? Said Johnny. The chief waved his hand, and Johnny saw that a fourth view screen had been installed, making two for the conference room.
He's been in here all the time you were on that platform, working a coordinator half to death, translating. They've got disks of everything that went on. The second screen was so they could see both you and the emissaries. I looked in here a time or two.
Mr. Tsung was volubly interrupting him. The chief translated.
He wants you to know that you are the fastest pupil he has ever seen. He says, if you had been an imperial prince of China and his family had still been chamberlains and not exiled, China would still be there.
Johnny laughed and would have acknowledged with a return compliment, but Mr. Tsung was talking very fast and drawing something from his sleeve.
He wants something, said the chief. He wants you to put your chop on this paper. That is, your signature.
He was unfolding it. It was a considerable expanse of Chinese characters. The chief raised his eyebrows and translated the sense of it for Johnny.
This says that you approved the cancellation of exile of his family from the imperial court, and that you recommend its reinstatement as chamberlains to the principal government of this planet and yourself.
I'm not a member of the government, said Johnny.
He knows all that, but he wants your chop on it. I warn you that he has two brothers and several relatives. They are all educated in diplomacy and such. Oh, he tells me there's a second paper here. Yes, this one restores their rank as mandarins of the blue button. Lets them wear a round cap with a blue button on top. Noblemen, actually. It's valid. They are noblemen.
But I'm not, began Johnny. Mr. Tsung sang off into half a dozen trills of protest.
He says you don't know what you are. Put your chop on these and he'll do the rest.
Johnny said, but I have no authority. The war isn't over yet. Not by a long ways.
He says wars are wars and diplomats are diplomats, and there is no point in the game when it ends. I'd sign them if I were you, Lord Johnny. They are all studying cyclo and English. It's his chance to attain an 1,100-year-old goal. I'll read these word for word for you.
Well, Johnny felt they might not have made it without Mr. Tsung, so he was given a brush and he signed them, and Chief Chong Wan witnessed them. Mr. Tsung reverently folded the pieces of paper into a cover of gold brocade and laid them away like they were crown jewels. Oh, yes, said Johnny as he left. One more thing. Tell him how much I enjoyed that tale about the dragon who ate the moon. Chapter 28 1 Cyclo, the home planet of 200,000 worlds, the center of an empire that had ruled and ruined 16 universes over a period of 302,000 years. Cyclo, that had been the cause of man's destruction. What had happened to its empire, if anything? What had happened to Cyclo? And if it still existed, what did it plan? Was it a danger or not? For a grueling and turbulent year, they had wondered. It lay like a nagging barb under their thoughts. Now they were going to find out. Pale light lit the bowl. The metal of the platform shone dully. Not a motor to be heard in the sky. The stars were bright above. Angus and Johnny looked at each other. Now they would know. First, said Johnny, we will inspect mine sites and see what transshipment rigs are active. Perhaps there is some indicator somewhere that would alert them to this. We will be cautious, not get too close to anything. The coordinate book told them of a transshipment rig at Luzite, a cyclo-mining world without population other than cyclo-miners. It was a large planet, but distant from cyclo. They put the new gyro cage down, put a picto recorder in the armored case, calculated the coordinates for a point 40 miles from the Luzite transshipment site, punched the console buttons, and fired. The wires hummed. The cage came back. There was a slight recoil. Johnny put the disc in the atmosphere projector that still stood there. He pressed the button. For a moment, both he and Angus thought they must have miscalculated and shot a mine instead. 40 miles was a long way off for detail, and Johnny adjusted and recentered the scene before them. It was a hole, but not a mine. There stood a transshipment pole at a drunken angle. But it was otherwise just a hole in the planet's surface, no trace even of compound domes. Johnny wondered whether they had different compound layouts on different planets. Perhaps that Luzite platform had been miles from anything else. Still, the Cyclos were demons for standard layouts. Usually the whole central administration of the planet was at the transshipment rig. For there was where the ore came from all over the planet. There was where the books were kept, where the main shops existed, where the top executives were. Just that hole. It was pretty big, but a hole is a hole. They chose another firing site, Mercogren, in the fifth universe. It was shown as a planet 5 times the size of Earth, but of less density. They fired and recalled the gyro cage. When Johnny turned the projector on, they saw at once they had something different. They had to widen the view on the projector to see better. Mercogren had been close to a mountain range, and avalanches had apparently come down. They would have covered much of the space of any compound. Johnny brought the view in closer. There, at the lower right, the inverted bowl of a compound dome. It was lying like a broken soup plate. There was a transshipment pole and attached charred wires sitting in the middle of it, but nothing else. So far, no tight conclusion could be reached beyond the fact that those central compounds and transshipment rigs were certainly no longer working. At random, they took another planet, Breloton. It was an inhabited planet, another reference told them, with a population of its own, governed by a cyclo regency, enduring such rule for 60,000 years. They calculated the coordinates for a spot 40 miles from the transshipment rig and fired the gyro cage. They were not prepared for what they got. The atmosphere image showed a city. The transshipment rig there had apparently been on a raised plateau in the center of town. Buildings that once must have been massive were blown to bits. They made a spreading pattern that radiated out from the plateau. Buildings that must have been 2,000 feet high in a city that must have held 1 million beings or more had fallen outward like dominoes. The remains of the rig were plain. The platform was a hole. The poles were all leaning outward. The compound domes had lain under the edge of the plateau and had been lifted by concussion and blown away, leaving the familiar underground layout plain in view. Bringing the compound in closer, one could see what must be a year's growth of grass in crevices. There was no sign of life. Johnny went back and sat down and thought. He asked Angus to find some views the air cover had taken at the Purgatoire River, views of the American compound. Angus got them, and Johnny looked at them. The hole where the platform had been, the outward lean of the poles that still stood, the blasted city 50 or more miles away. I know what happened, said Johnny. We could go on looking at cycloplanets all night and get the same answer. Give me that computer. We're going to look at Cyclo on day 92 last year. Light. It traveled approximately 5,869,713,600,000 miles a year. The light which came from Cyclo on that hour and date was still traveling in space. They would get just ahead of it, and with a picto recorder from a star drone set for 6 trillion times magnification, they would look at Cyclo at the instant it occurred. Whatever had occurred. It had been just a few days ago, over a year ago. Choose the sidereal angle to aim the scope. Avoid nearby heavenly bodies so that the cage would not be influenced by gravity and would stay there for 2 or 3 minutes. No, let's be brave and put it there for 15 minutes and hope it doesn't move and we get it back. It took a while to set up. They had to readjust magnification, tune in heat sensors, and blind them to other bodies. Calculate seconds. They fired the cage. The wires hummed in holding for the long required time. They called the cage back. It arrived. It was a little misplaced on the platform.